The prioress in Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is something less than a humble holy woman. She lives a comfortable, even luxurious lifestyle. She values her lapdogs above most people. The rosary she carries is made with precious stones, and she wears a gold brooch on which it's engraved, Amor vincit omnia, love conquers all. You're listening to The After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tomkowicz. The romantic notion that love conquers all is hardly a relic of the past. To judge by many modern movies, popular songs, and books, we still dream of being overcome by the power of love and swept up into a happily ever after. And that idea has been around for at least 1,000 years, beginning with the medieval romances. Dr. Tiffany Schubert has been studying medieval romances and recently led a faculty symposium about the topic here at Wyoming Catholic College. I asked Dr. Schubert what it was about medieval romances that first grabbed her attention.
I think that I loved the combination of a novelist's attention to the inner life, the habits, the manners, the loves between people, combined with the fanciful, the fairy, the magical, and the sometimes downright ridiculousness of medieval romances. It's something that, as a modern reader, you don't get a whole lot, is that particular kind of combination. And there's something really delightful about both getting this insight into the characters' hearts, and also you have fairies showing up and stealing somebody's wife.
Okay. Well, what would be some examples of the genre? Ones that we would know and maybe ones that are your favorites?
So the best medieval romance would be Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the best and the most famous. That's the one that is still actually read in many classrooms. And it really is artistically top notch. It's hard to find any other romance that really competes with its keen insight into delicate social and moral dilemmas, really rich characterization, it's sort of eerie, kind of unsettling, kind of magical quality. So that's the top one. There's some really, really great ones. Sir Orfeo is another one I think that I really recommend. Not as good as Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, but another is this really lovely portrait of a married couple whose happy marriage is disrupted by the fairy king, who comes and steals the wife away, and sort of all about the husband then going after her and rescuing her. It's kind of a retelling of the Orpheus story. Chrétien de Troyes is probably one of the most famous of the romancers, French author in the 11th century, and he gives us some really, I think, lovely portraits of knights setting out on adventures and finding themselves, sort of adventure as a process of growth and maturation. And also he gives us several very, very beautiful intimate portraits of marriage as well.
Now, would Canterbury Tales be included, or would the Arthurian stories?
So Chaucer will play with the romance as a genre. So the Man of Law's Tale would be a romance, or the Franklin's Tale would also be romances. So Chaucer knows, he knows the tropes of these stories, and he's really quite excellent at them. So it'd be a great place to go to as well. Chaucer's interesting because he's just so knowing about the kinds of stories that he's telling. Right? There's nothing naive about Chaucer. He's extremely sophisticated. So he's a lot of fun in that sense. You can see him perhaps kind of satirizing the romance genre, right? As well as telling really authentic romantic stories. Mm-hmm. And then, the Arthurian legends are also a big part of that. So Chrétien de Troyes is writing a lot of Arthurian romances. He's the guy who gives us the first mention of Lancelot and Guinevere's romantic relationship, and he gives us stories of Arthurian knights themselves. So not all medieval romances involve Arthur, but some of the best do. And then, of course, Malory. And, of course, right, the Morte Arthur is sort of the culmination of the Arthurian cycle.
Mm-hmm. You said in the symposium that romance comes from, maybe is even dependent on, a Christian world. How so? And could you give us some examples?
So certainly romances in the Middle Ages are coming out of the Christian story, right? So we've got the Christian story being a story of creation, of fall, the incarnation, redemption, and then eventually glorification in the new heaven and the new earth. And this story is really worked out in all of its fullness in the Middle Ages. And that story shapes the kinds of stories that are being told by the storytellers of the period. And so the romancers are influenced by the comedy that is the Christian story. The Christian story is a story that ends, that begins well, and that has this extremely long period of suffering and pain, but then ends well. And so just that kind of understanding of how life works is underpinning the romances. So I think it's helpful, especially for someone who hasn't read a lot of them, when you sort of first start reading, they seem so outrageous and unbelievable. I mean, how could these people have possibly accepted stories like this with endings like this in which everything is made right and all of these characters who have turned against each other or, you know, had been separated, they're all together, right? It's so unrealistic. But if we see that the romance is coming out of this Christian story, the Christian comedy, then we think realize that they're much more grounded in theological truth than in a kind of hyper-materialistic realism.
Well, but we also have plenty of movies, for example, and books that are precisely the same kind of thing. One of my favorite movies is The Philadelphia Story. In the beginning of the movie, Katharine Hepburn throws Cary Grant out of the house and breaks his golf clubs. And at the end, it's happily ever after, or the hints of that. Through a long period of trial and suffering. So it's still with us, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, for all of our cynicism and skepticism towards romance or towards happy ending, there's still something about it that speaks deeply to us, and there's still something in it that we long for. And I think that from a theological perspective, we would say that it is that longing for the Christian story. And for those tastes and hints of the happiness for which we were created. And so even something like the Philadelphia story is giving that to us.
Now, I know that one of the questions you have in looking at medieval romances is the nature of Christian storytellers. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this question that I've been thinking about came out of a conference, and I've been really wondering. Someone in the conference said something like, "It's not that Christians are better storytellers than anyone else, but that as Christians we have an insight into the act of storytelling and into stories themselves that non-Christians don't." And I think that one of those insights might be this idea that stories are a blessing to us. And by blessing, I mean, right, it's a bestowal of some kind of good. And I think that good can be an imaginative good. So the experience of, say, the Philadelphia story, or of a romance like Sir Orfeo, can give us this invitation into a world of love and of happiness. That's a kind of rescuing us from the confusion and the drudgery of daily life. So it's a sort of a baptism of the imagination, you could say, by taking us out of our daily experience. And then in the medieval romances themselves, a lot of the storytellers, these Christian storytellers, are actually praying. So they'll begin their stories with prayer, and then they'll end their stories with prayer. So, and those prayers will, especially the ones at the end, will often be for blessing, particularly for the final and complete blessing, paradise.
Well, we left the symposium with the unanswered question about how the romance differs from the novel. Have you given any more thought to that question?
So, I mean, historically, the romance is the father of the novel. The novel comes out of these medieval stories about ladies and knights and marriage and adventure. But the novel comes out of the romance in part rejecting it, or at least making fun of it, or very seriously critiquing it. And I think that there's some sense of the idealism of romance has to be tempered by the realism of the novel. And I think that's maybe one of the differences there. So this is not to say that novels don't have ideal characters, ideal happiness, even in some sense ideal villains, right? Villains who are just sort of perfectly villainous, and all of those, right? Tropes of the romance, which tends to work in ideals. Every woman is the most beautiful woman you've ever seen in a romance, and every knight is the bravest, powerful knight that you've ever met. And so there's some of that element in the novel, but the novel also gives us a sense of the constraints and the limitations of the human person. And it sees, especially a novel like Don Quixote is really thinking about what happens when you live in this ideal world, the world of heightened characters and heightened adventure constantly, all the time. In some ways, it makes you unfit to live in this world. And so the novel is very much interested in living in this world and acknowledging characters who are, imperfect and can't live up to their ideals or just won't live up to their ideals. What do you do with that? And I think it's a really important question to ask, and it's a really important element in the novel.
Well, we've already talked about this a little bit, but compare the medieval stories of romance with the ones we have today, and the way our minds are still formed by this romantic ideal.
So I think we have to maybe think about that word romance there a little bit. So we tend to think of romance as focusing on stories about love between a man and a woman, generally. And these medieval romance there really just kind of means stories not told, not written in Latin, but stories written in, romantic languages. So the spoken languages of the people. So the romances, the medieval romances, are all kinds of stories. Stories about kings who are betrayed by their stewards and, kind of come back and find their way back. So the kind of idea of the restoration of the true king or turn of the king, such a romance, right? That Tolkien knows the tropes of the genre really, really well. But yeah, a lot of those romances do focus in on love. And I think our stereotype of the Middle Ages is these are adulterous stories, so we think like Lancelot and Guinevere, or Tristan and Isolde. That's sort of our go-to when we think medieval romance. Right? But actually, most of the romances are those romances that focus in on love are directed towards marriage, and so sometimes it will be the couple married at the very beginning who undergo marital troubles and trials and come out stronger in the end. And sometimes it's the characters who work towards marriage, and then you end with that, with the marriage, and that kind of full happiness, full marital happiness. And so that gets carried on into the novel, and then that gets carried on into the stories that we still tell today in our romantic, right, in the romantic comedies. They're distant but direct descendants of the medieval romances.
Helen Cooper, in her book, The English Romance in Time, wrote, "It is no accident that the great age of romance was also the great age of faith. Romance, with its typical pattern of an opening disruption of a state of order, followed by a period of trial and suffering, even an encounter with death, yet with a final symbolic resurrection and better restoration, offers a secular equivalent to the divine order. Which makes me wonder what romances can show our neighbors about life and love and the life of love in Jesus Christ. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.